Chapter 51. What else can we do? After this piece of sincerity, he cannot be dangerous any longer. The other muttered, better make sure of that, before we let him go. Leave that to me. I know how to deal with such gentlemen. He exchanged meaning glances with two or three men, who nodded slightly, then turning roughly to Razumov, you have heard. You are not wanted here. Why don't you get out? The Laspara girl on guard rose, and pulled the chair out of the way unemotionally. She gave a sleepy stare to Razumov, who started, looked around the room and passed slowly by her, as if struck by some sudden thought. I beg you to observe, he said, already on the landing, that I had only to hold my tongue. Today, of all days, since I came amongst you, I was made safe, and today I made myself free from falsehood, from remorse independent of every single human being on this earth. He turned his back on the room, and walked towards the stairs, but, at the violent crash of the door behind him, he looked over his shoulder and saw that Nikita, with three others, had followed him out. They are going to kill me after all, he thought. Before he had time to turn round and confront them fairly, they set on him with a rush. He was driven headlong against the wall. Wonder how, he completed his thought. Nikita cried, with a shrill laugh right in his face, we shall make you harmless. You wait a bit. Razumov did not struggle. The three men held him pinned against the wall, while Nikita, taking up a position a little on one side, deliberately swung off his enormous arm. Razumov, looking for a knife in his hand, saw it come at him open, unarmed, and received a tremendous blow on the side of his head over his ear. At the same time he heard a faint, dull detonating sound, as if someone had fired a pistol on the other side of the wall. A raging fury awoke in him at this outrage. The people in Laspara's rooms, holding their breath, listened to the desperate scuffling of four men all over the landing, thuds against the walls, a terrible crash against the very door, then all of them went down together with a violence which seemed to shake the whole house. Razumov, overpowered, breathless, crushed under the weight of his assailants, saw the monstrous Nikita squatting on his heels near his head, while the others held him down, kneeling on his chest, gripping his throat, lying across his legs. Turn his face the other way, the paunchy terrorist directed, in an excited, gleeful squeak. Razumov could struggle no longer. He was exhausted. He had to watch passively the heavy open hand of the brute descend again in a degrading blow over his other ear. It seemed to split his head in two, and all at once the men holding him became perfectly silent, soundless as shadows. In silence they pulled him brutally to his feet, rushed with him noiselessly down the staircase, and, opening the door, flung him out into the street. He fell forward, and at once rolled over and over helplessly, going down the short slope together with the rush of running rainwater. He came to rest in the roadway of the street at the bottom, lying on his back, with a great flash of lightning over his face, a vivid, silent flash of lightning which blinded him utterly. He picked himself up, and put his arm over his eyes to recover his sight. Not a sound reached him from anywhere, and he began to walk, staggering, down a long, empty street. The lightning waved and darted round him its silent flames, the water of the deluge fell, ran, leaped, drove noiseless like the drift of mist. In this unearthly stillness his footsteps fell silent on the pavement, while a dumb wind drove him on and on, like a lost mortal in a phantom world ravaged by a soundless thunderstorm. God only knows where his noiseless feet took him to that night, here and there, and back again without pause or rest. Of one place, at least, where they did lead him, we heard afterwards. And, in the morning, the driver of the first South Shore tramcar, clanging his bell desperately, saw a bedraggled, soaked man without a hat, and walking in the roadway unsteadily with his head down, step right in front of his car, and go under. When they picked him up, with two broken limbs and a crushed side, Razumov had not lost consciousness. It was as though he had tumbled, smashing himself, into a world of mutes. Silent men, moving unheard, lifted him up, laid him on the sidewalk, gesticulating and grimacing round him their alarm, horror, and compassion. A red face with mustaches stooped close over him, lips moving, eyes rolling. Razumov tried hard to understand the reason of this dumb show. To those who stood around him, the features of that stranger, so grievously hurt, seemed composed in meditation. Afterwards his eyes sent out at them a look of fear and closed slowly. They stared at him. Razumov made an effort to remember some French words. Jesus sword he had time to utter feebly before he fainted. He is deaf, they exclaimed to each other. That's why he did not hear the car. They carried him off in that same car. Before it started on its journey, a woman in a shabby black dress, who had run out of the iron gate of some private grounds up the road, clambered onto the rear platform and would not be put off. I am a relation, she insisted, in bad French. His young man is a Russian, and I am his relation. On this plea they let her have her way. She sat down calmly and took his head on her lap. Her scared, faded eyes avoided looking at his death-like face. At the corner of a street, on the other side of the town, a stretcher met the car. She followed it to the door of the hospital, where they let her come in and see him laid on a bed. Razumov's newfound relation never shed a tear, but the officials had some difficulty in inducing her to go away. The porter observed her lingering on the opposite pavement for a long time. Suddenly, as though as he had remembered something, she ran off. The ardent hater of all finance ministers, the slave of Madame de S, had made up her mind to offer her resignation as lady companion to the Egeria of Peter Ivanovich. As he had found work to do after her own heart. But hours before, while the thunderstorm still raged in the night, there had been in the rooms of Julius Laspara a great sensation. The terrible Nikita, coming in from the landing, uplifted his squeaky voice in horrible glee before all the company, Razumov. Mr. Razumov. The wonderful Razumov. He shall never be any use as a spy on anyone. He won't talk, because he will never hear anything in his life, not a thing. I have burst the drums of his ears for him. Oh, you may trust me. I know the trick. Ha! 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 I know the trick. It was nearly a fortnight after her mother's funeral that I saw Natalia Alden for the last time. In those silent, somber days the doors of the apartment on the Boulevard des Philosophes were closed to everyone but myself. I believe I was of some use, if only in this, that I alone was aware of the incredible part of the situation. Miss Alden nursed her mother alone to the last moment. If Razumov's visit had anything to do with Mrs. Alden's end, and I cannot help thinking that it hastened it considerably, it is because the man, trusted impulsively by the ill-fated Victor Alden, had failed to gain the confidence of Victor Alden's mother. What tale, precisely, he told her cannot be known at any rate, I do not know it, but to me, she seemed to die from the shock of an ultimate disappointment born in silence. As he had not believed him. Perhaps she could not longer believe anyone, and consequently had nothing to say to anyone, not even to her daughter. I suspect that Miss Alden lived the heaviest hours of her life by that silent deathbed. I confess I was angry with the broken-hearted old woman passing away in the obstinacy of her mute distrust of her daughter. When it was all over I stood aside. Miss Alden had her compatriots round her then. A great number of them attended the funeral. I was there too, but afterwards managed to keep away from Miss Alden, till I received a short note rewarding my self-denial. Tis as you would have it. I am going back to Russia at once. My mind is made up. Come and see me. Verily, it was a reward of discretion. I went without delay to receive it. The apartment of the Boulevard des Philosophes presented the dreary signs of impending abandonment. It looked desolate, and as if already empty to my eyes. Standing, we exchanged a few words about her health, mine, remarks as to some people of the Russian colony, and then Natalia Eldon, establishing me on the sofa, began to talk openly of her future work, of her plans. It was all to be as I had wished it. And it was to be for life. We should never see each other again. Never. I gathered this success to my breast. Natalia Eldon looked matured by her open and secret experiences. With her arms folded, she walked up and down the whole length of the room, talking slowly, smooth-browed, with a resolute profile. She gave me a new view of herself, and I marveled at that something grave and measured in her voice, in her movements, in her manner. It was the perfection of collected independence. The strength of her nature had come to surface, because the obscure depths had been stirred. We too can talk of it now, she observed, after a silence and stopping short before me. Have you been to inquire at the hospital lately? Yes, I have. And as she looked at me fixedly, he will live, the doctors say. But I thought that Tekla. Tekla has not been near me for several days, explained Miss Eldon quickly. S. I never offered to go to the hospital with her. She thinks that I have no heart. She is disillusioned about me. And Miss Eldon smiled faintly. Yes. She sits with him as long, and as often as they will let her, I said. He says she must never abandon him, never, as long as she lives. He'll need somebody a hopeless cripple, and stone deaf with that. Stone deaf? I didn't know, murmured Natalia Eldon. He is. It seems strange. I am told there were no apparent injuries to the head. They say, too, that it is not very likely that he will live so very long for Tekla to take care of him. Miss Eldon shook her head. While there are travelers ready to fall by the way, our Tekla shall never be idle. She is a good Samaritan by an irresistible vocation. The revolutionists didn't understand her. Fancy a devoted creature like that being employed to carry about documents sewn in her dress, or made to write from dictation. There is not much perspicacity in the world. No sooner uttered, I regretted that observation. Natalia Eldon, looking me straight in the face, assented by a slight movement of her head. She was not offended, but turning away began to pace the room again. To my Western eyes, she seemed to be getting farther and farther from me, quite beyond my reach now, but undiminished in the increasing distance. I remained silent, as though it were hopeless to raise my voice. The sound of hers, so close to me, made me start a little. Tekla saw him picked up after the accident. The good soul never explained to me really how it came about. She affirms that there was some understanding between them, some sort of compact, that in any sore need, in misfortune, or difficulty, or pain, he was to come to her. Was there? I said. He is lucky for him that there was, then. He'll need all the devotion of the Good Samaritan. It was a fact that Tekla, looking out of her window at 5 in the morning, for some reason or other, had beheld Razumov in the grounds of the Chateau Borel, standing stock still, bareheaded in the rain, at the foot of the terrace. She had screamed out to him, by name, to know what was the matter. He never even raised his head. By the time as he had dressed herself sufficiently to run downstairs, he was gone. She started in pursuit, and rushing out into the road, came almost directly upon the arrested tramcar and the small knot of people picking up Razumov. That much Tekla had told me herself one afternoon we happened to meet at the door of the hospital, and without any kind of comment. But I did not want to meditate very long on the inwardness of this peculiar episode. Yes, Natalia Viktorovna, he shall need somebody when they dismiss him, on crutches and stone deaf from the hospital. But I do not think that, when he rushed like an escaped madman into the grounds of the Chateau Borel, it was to seek the help of that good Tekla. No, said Natalia, stopping short before me, perhaps not. She sat down, and leaned her head on her hand thoughtfully. The silence lasted for several minutes. During that time I remembered the evening of his atrocious confession, the plaint she seemed to have hardly enough life left in her to utter, "It is impossible to be more unhappy." The recollection would have given me a shudder, if I had not been lost in wonder at her force and her tranquility. There was no longer any Natalia Alden, because she had completely ceased to think of herself. It was a great victory, a characteristically Russian exploit in self-suppression. She recalled me to myself, by getting up suddenly like a person who has come to a decision. She walked to the writing table, now stripped of all the small objects associated with her by daily use, a mere piece of dead furniture. But it contained something living, still, since she took from a recess a flat parcel which she brought to me. "It's a book," she said rather abruptly. "Tea was sent to me wrapped up in my veil. I told you nothing at the time, but now I've decided to leave it with you. I have the right to do that. It was sent to me. It is mine. You may preserve it, or destroy it after you have read it. And while you read it, please remember that I was defenseless. And the tea." "Defenseless?" I repeated, surprised, looking hard at her. "You'll find the very word written there," she whispered. It's true. I was defenseless, but perhaps you were able to see that for yourself." Her face colored, then went deadly pale. "And justice to the man, I want you to remember that I was. I was. I rose, a little shakily. I am not likely to forget anything you say at this our last parting." Her hand fell into mine. "It's difficult to believe that it must be goodbye with us." She returned my pressure and our hands separated. "Yes. I am leaving here tomorrow. My eyes are open at last, and my hands are free now. As for the rest, which of us can fail to hear the stifled cry of our great distress? It may be nothing to the world. The world is more conscious of your discordant voices," I said. "Tea is the way of the world." "Yes." She bowed her head in assent, and hesitated for a moment. "Must own to you, that I shall never give up looking forward to the day, when all discord shall be silenced. Try to imagine its dawn. The tempest of blows, and of execrations is over, all is still. The new sun is rising, and the weary men united at last, taking count in their conscience of the ended contest, feel saddened by their victory, because so many ideas have perished for the triumph of one, so many beliefs have abandoned them without support. They feel alone on the earth and gather close together. Yes, there must be many bitter hours, but at last the anguish of hearts shall be extinguished in love." And on this last word of her wisdom, a word so sweet, so bitter, so cruel sometimes, I said goodbye to Natalia Alden. It is hard to think I shall never look any more into the trustful eyes of that girl wedded to an invincible belief in the advent of loving concord springing like a heavenly flower from the soil of men's earth, soaked in blood, torn by struggles, watered with tears. It must be understood that at that time I didn't know anything of Mr. Razumov's confession to the assembled revolutionists. Natalia Alden might have guessed what was the anything more which remained for him to do, but this my Western eyes had failed to see. Tekla, the ex-lady companion of Madame de S., haunted his bedside at the hospital. We met once or twice at the door of that establishment, but on these occasions she was not communicative. She gave me news of Mr. Razumov as concisely as possible. He was making a slow recovery, but would remain a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.